Good evening. It's a great pleasure and honor to be introducing two world-class writers tonight, both of them at the forefront of their respective fields. Colm Tobin, who'll read first, is a novelist, essayist, playwright, short story writer. His many books include The Blackwater Lightship, shortlisted for the Booker Prize, The Master, which won the Impact Prize, and the LA Times Book Prize, and was also shortlisted for the Booker, and most recently the novel Brooklyn, which won the Costa Book of the Year Prize in the UK. Born in County Wexford, Ireland in 1955, Colm Tobin seems to have lived the enviable, exemplary life of the itinerant author, his wide knowledge of the world enabling him to write with equal authority about Ireland, England, South America, Catholic Europe, and of course, the states where his latest novel is partly set. Like him, his characters are often exiles or semi-exiles. Henry James in The Master, setting up house in England, traveling in Ireland and Italy. Or the young provincial girl who emigrates from a small Irish town in the 1950s to New York in Brooklyn. I could go on at great length about the brilliance of these books, the depth in which they explore the special kinds of solitude and human connection peculiar to the condition of exile, the austere beauty of the writing, the quiet intensity of the action. But since I know there are many writers in the audience tonight, I thought it might be more interesting to leave you with something of more immediate practical interest, namely Colm Tobin's 10 rules for writing, as listed in a recent article in The Guardian. Number one, finish everything you start. Number two, get on with it. Number three, stay in your mental pajamas all day. Number four, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Number five, no alcohol, sex, or drugs while you are working. Six, work in the morning, a short break for lunch, work in the afternoon, and then watch the 6 o'clock news, and then go back to work until bedtime. Before bed, listen to Schubert, preferably some songs. Number seven, if you have to read, to cheer yourself up, read biographies of writers who went insane. Number eight, on Saturdays, you can watch an old Bergman film, preferably Persona or Autumn Sonata. Nine, no going to London. 10, no going anywhere else either. I should note that one of the other contributors to this article, I think it was the novelist Sarah Waters, gave us her first rule, read the books of Colm Tobin. Please join me in a warm welcome for Colm Tobin.
The last time I came into this room was under very different circumstances. As Jesse will know, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were very nice to let me in. But I brought two friends from Ireland, and I think they were pretty surprised by what they saw in here. It was one of those gay nights when even the people who weren't naked seemed quite naked to them, and indeed to me, and it was very exciting. But this is a better audience in many ways. I mean, one never knows what will happen. It's Good Friday. The honor I have, it's considerable honor, is to play the part that John the Baptist once played. But I think we've learned our lessons over 2,000 years that the outcome perhaps will be different in when Jesus comes in the second half. It's 1951. It's the town of Enniscorthy in the southeast of Ireland, which is also where I'm from. And Eilish Lacey is a young woman. She can't get a job. And her family organized for her, courtesy of a priest who lives in Brooklyn, a job in Brooklyn. And they sort of, all around her, organize everything for her, get everything ready for her. And it's considered a great opportunity, and everyone thinks that. And I suppose it is a great opportunity in the sense that there's a great difference in those years, and even the years before and after, in emigrating to America versus going to England. I suppose the easiest way of putting this is that you could go to America and your descendants could become president, but if you went to England, well, it would be very hard for your descendants to become queen. You know, it wouldn't be automatic. You'd have to, I don't know what you'd have to do, but it wouldn't really, you know, it wouldn't be part of your great plan. Anyway, she's going to go to America. Her sister is called Rose. She's living at home. Her sister has a job at home. She's older. and she's more deliberate. She's the one who makes decisions in the house. So Eilish is living with her mother and her sister Rose in this. I'm going to read three short bits of the book, and this is one just before Eilish gets ready to go. Even when she woke in the night and thought about it, she did not allow herself to conclude that she did not want to go. Instead, she went over all the arrangements and worried about carrying two suitcases with all her clothes without any help and making sure she did not lose the handbag that Rose had given her, where she would keep her passport and the addresses in Brooklyn where she would live and work, and Father Flood's address in case he did not turn up to meet her as he had promised to do, and money and her makeup bag. And an overcoat, maybe to be carried over her arm, although perhaps she would wear it, she thought, unless it was too hot. And it still might be hot in late September, she had been warned. She'd already packed one case and hoped as she went over its contents in her mind that she would not have to open it again. It struck her on one of those nights as she lay awake that the next time she would open that suitcase would be in a different room in a different country. And then the thought came unbidden into her mind that she would be happier if it were opened by another person who could keep the clothes and shoes and wear them every day. She would prefer to stay at home, sleep in this room, live in this house, do without the clothes and shoes. The arrangements being made, all the bustle and talk would be better if it were for someone else, she thought. Someone like her, someone the same age and size, who maybe even looked the same as she did. As long as she, the person who was thinking now, could wake in this bed every morning and move as the day went on in these familiar streets and come home to the kitchen, to her mother and Rose. Even though she let these thoughts run as fast as they would, she still stopped when her mind moved towards real fear or dread, or worse, towards the thought that she was going to lose this world forever, that she would never have an ordinary day again in this ordinary place, that the rest of her life would be a struggle with the unfamiliar. Downstairs, once Rose and her mother were there, she talked about practical things and remained bright. One evening, Rose invited her into her room so that she could choose some pieces of jewelry to bring with her. Something new occurred to Eilish that surprised her by its force and clarity. Rose was 30 now, and since it was obvious that their mother could never be left to live alone, not merely because her pension was small, but because she would be too lonely without any of them, Eilish's going, which Rose had organized so precisely, would mean that Rose would not be able to marry. She would have to stay with her mother, living as she was now, working in Davis's office, playing golf at the weekends and on summer evenings. Rose, she realized, in making it easy for her to go, was giving up any real prospect of leaving this house herself and having her own house with her own family. Eilish, as she fitted on some necklaces, seated in front of the dressing table mirror, saw that in the future, as her mother got older and more frail, Rose would have to care for her even more, go up the steep steps of the stairs with trays of food and do the cleaning and cooking when her mother could not. It occurred to her also, as she tried on some earrings, that Rose knew all this too. Knew that either she or Eilish would have to leave, and decided to let Eilish go. As she turned and looked at her sister, Eilish wanted to suggest that they change places, that Rose, so ready for life, always making new friends, would be happier going to America, just as Eilish would be quite content to stay at home. But Rose had a job in the town and she did not. And so it was easy for Rose to sacrifice herself, since it seemed that she was doing something else. In these moments, as Rose offered her some brooches to take with her, Eilish would have given anything to be able to say plainly that she did not want to go, that Rose could go instead, that she would happily stay here and take care of her mother, and they would manage somehow, and maybe she would find other work. She wondered if her mother, too, believed that the wrong sister was leaving, and understood also what Rose's motives were. She imagined her mother knew everything. They knew so much, each of them, she thought, that they could do everything except say out loud what it was they were thinking. She resolved as she went back to her room that she would do everything she could for them by pretending at all times that she was filled with excitement at the great adventure in which she was ready to embark. She would make them believe, if she could, that she was looking forward to America and leaving home for the first time. She promised herself that not for one moment would she give them the smallest hint of how she felt, and she would keep it from herself if she had to, until she was away from them. There was, she thought, enough sadness in the house, maybe even more than she realized. She would try as best she could not to add to it. Her mother and Rose could not be fooled, she was sure. But there seemed to her an even greater reason why there should be no tears before her departure. They would not be needed. What she would need to do in the days before she left and on the morning of her departure was smile, so that they would remember her smiling. Anyway, she arrives in Brooklyn and she begins to miss home, and she's working in a department store. And when she gets really homesick, Father Flood, who's organizing everything for her, he finds her a night class in Brooklyn College where she's studying bookkeeping. But part of the bookkeeping has a module called law, and there's a law lecturer called Mr. Rosenblum. And he really is giving very complicated lectures, and she's so conscientious, and she's afraid that she's going to fail law. So she asks him if maybe there are books she could read so that she could understand what he's talking about. And he gives her a list of three books, and he gives her the name of a specialist law bookstore in Manhattan, so she has to go in and try and find these books. Eilish, I just want to say that this is 1951, and that Eilish is coming out of the Republic of Ireland, that during the war, during the Second World War, the Republic of Ireland was more or less a closed place. In other words, it was neutral. The war was not called a war in our country. It was called the emergency. And there was censorship even about news, so that it was only afterwards certain things became apparent through newsreel, but it was very distant. In other words, that no one in this world had brothers, fathers, uncles, or members of the family who were coming back from the war, who were going to fight, who were being killed, or coming back injured. So that it was a strange world to come out of in 1951, where certain things had not fully sort of entered public consciousness. Eilish walked around the store first, studying titles on the shelves, aware now that some of the books were old and maybe secondhand. It was easy for her to imagine Mr. Rosenblum here browsing, with one or two big books open in front of him, or using the ladder to get something from the higher shelves. She knew as she browsed that she would have no hope of finding the three books on her list in the middle of all the other books. So when she was approached by an old man who had come from behind the desk, she simply handed him the list and said these were the books she had come looking for. The man, who was wearing thick glasses, had to raise them onto his forehead so that he could read. He squinted. "Is this your handwriting?" "No, it's my lecturer's. He recommended these books." "Are you a law student?" "Not really, but it's part of the course." "What's your lecturer's name?" "Mr. Rosenblum." "Joshua Rosenblum?" "I don't know his name." "What are you studying?" "I'm doing a night course at Brooklyn College." "That's Joshua Rosenblum. I'd know his writing." He peered again at the piece of paper and the titles. "He's clever," the man said. "Yes, he's very good," she replied. "Can you imagine?" The man began, but turned towards the cash desk before he finished. He was agitated. She followed him slowly. "You want these books, then?" He spoke almost aggressively. "Yes, I do." "Joshua Rosenblum?" the man asked. Can you imagine a country would want to kill him?" Eilish stepped back but did not reply. "Well, can you?" What do you mean?" she asked. "The Germans killed everyone belonging to him, murdered every one of them. But we got him out. At least we did that. We got Joshua Rosenblum out." "You mean in the war?" The man did not reply. He moved across the store and found a small footstool onto which he climbed to fetch a book. As he descended, he turned towards her angrily. "Can you imagine? a country would want to do that. It should be wiped off the face of the earth. He looked at her bitterly. In the war, she asked again, in the Holocaust, in the Cherbourg, but was it in the war? It was. It was in the war, the man replied, the expression on his face suddenly gentle. As he busied himself finding the other two books, he had a resigned, almost stubborn look. By the time he returned to the counter and prepared the bill for her, he had come to seem distant and forbidding. She did not ask him any questions as she handed him the money. He wrapped the books for her and gave her the change. She sensed that he wanted her to leave the store, and there was nothing she could do to make him tell her anything more. And the last bit is her first Christmas away from home. And one of the funny things about New York in its relationship to Ireland is that the best Irish musicians, traditional musicians, came from the west coast of Ireland, a line going from Donegal, Sligo, Mayo, Galway, down into Clare and Kerry. And the one thing missing was a recording studio. So we don't have recordings, even when you could make recordings. We don't have recordings of those early musicians. And even at one point when a certain tradition of playing the violin, playing the Irish fiddle was dying out in Sligo, the only way to get it back was via recordings, to bring recordings back in, to let people listen to them. But those recordings had not been made in Ireland. Many of them have been made outside Ireland. And of course you could get a recording studio in New York. And you could rent them per hour in New York, basement recording studios. And I love the idea of jazz musicians finishing up and two Irish guys, one with a fiddle or a flute, arriving and them looking at each other for a minute, and the guys playing the jazz saying, "We're going to finish in a minute," and the other guys watching and then passing each other, and then the guys, the Irish musicians, making their recordings. But that the actual best early recordings we have of our traditional music were made in New York. The figure I had in mind here, I mean, it's slightly out of place because he actually left Ireland. He certainly wasn't an American in 51. He didn't leave until the 60s. And a friend of mine was at what was called in Ireland, it was a common term, was at his American wake, meaning that people thought they would never see him again because he was going to America. So they called it an American wake. And his name was Joe Heaney. And he's probably the greatest singer we've ever had in Ireland who's been recorded. And he had thousands of songs, and he just seriously beautiful voice. And he arrived in America, and he worked as a doorman in New York. Eventually, he was discovered, you know, well, he'd always been discovered in a way. People knew how good he was in Ireland and among that small community in New York. But he was discovered here by a university department. He was given a job in a university. And then he was discovered again by John Cage. And John Cage, which is sort of this, one of those beautiful ideas, John Cage wrote an oratorio for his voice, which is called Roratorio, which is based on Finnegan's Wake, which is, you know, John Cage meets Joe Heaney, the most unlikely thing possible. And also further unlikelihood, you can get it now on iTunes, and I actually have it on my iPod. Anyway, it's Christmas 1951. I have built a little parish hall at St. Boniface's in Brooklyn. Doesn't have one, but luckily I could build one for the novel. And Father Flood, who organizes everything for everybody, has organized that any man, any of the old Irish men in New York, in the boroughs, who don't have anywhere to go on Christmas Day, can come to him, and he'll feed them. And two women called Miss Murphy and Eilish, he asks her as a special favor if she'll do the cooking for the day, and they feed these men. Earlier in the day, a man has come into the hall. For a second, in the way he was dressed, just in the whole way he looked, Eilish thought it was her father. But her father's dead. And anyway, so far away from home. But just for a second, in the way his cap and his scarf and the way he takes in the room. She's sort of disconcerted by that idea for the rest of the day. And she notices that the man is talking Irish at a certain point. And anyway, she gets on because she's busy for the rest of the day. And this is towards the end of Christmas Day. By the time they were removing the trifle dishes, the hall was a mass of smoke and animated talk. Men sat in groups with one or two standing behind them. Others moved from group to group, some with bottles of whiskey in brown paper bags that they passed around. when all the cleaning of the kitchen and the filling of garbage cans had been completed. Father Flood suggested that they go into the hall and join the men for a drink. Some visitors had arrived, including a few women. And Eilish thought, as she sat down with a glass of sherry in her hand, that it could have been a parish hall anywhere in Ireland on the night of a concert or a wedding, when the young people were all elsewhere dancing or standing at the bar. After a while, Eilish noticed that two men had taken out fiddles and another, a small accordion. They had found a corner and were playing as a few others stood around and listened. Father Flood was moving about the hall with a notebook now, writing down names and addresses and nodding as old men spoke to him. After a while, he clapped his hands and called for silence, but it took a few minutes before he could get everyone's attention. I don't want to interrupt the proceedings, he said, but I'd like to thank a nice girl from Enniscorthy and two nice women from Arklow for their hard day's work. There was a round of applause. And as a way of thanking them, there's one great singer in this hall, and we're delighted to see him this year again. He pointed to the man whom Eilish had mistaken for her father. He was sitting away from Eilish and Father Flood, but he stood up when his name was called and walked quietly towards them. He stood with his back to the wall so everyone could see him. That man, Miss Murphy whispered to Eilish, has made LPs. When Eilish looked up, the man was signaling to her. He wanted her, it seemed, to come and stand with him. It struck her for a second that he might want her to sing, so she shook her head. But he kept beckoning, and people began to turn and look at her. She felt she had no choice but to leave her seat and approach him. She could not think why he wanted her. As she came close, she saw how bad his teeth were. He did not greet her or acknowledge her arrival, but closed his eyes and reached his hand towards hers and held it. The skin on the palm of his hand was soft. He gripped her hand tightly and began to move it in a faint circular motion as he started to sing. His voice was loud and strong and nasal. The Irish he sang in, she thought, must be Connemara Irish, because she remembered one teacher from Galway in the Mercy Convent who had that accent. He pronounced each word carefully and slowly, building up a wildness, a ferocity in the way he treated the melody. It was only when he came to the chorus, however, that she understood the words. Mahavien tuhulam astorima kri. And he glanced at her proudly, almost possessively, as he sang these lines. All the people in the hall watched him silently. There were five or six verses. He sang the words out with pure innocence and charm, so that at times when he closed his eyes, leaning his large frame against the wall, he did not seem like an old man. The strength of his voice and the confidence of his performance had taken over. And then each time he came to the chorus, he looked at her, letting the melody become sweeter by slowing down the pace, putting his head down then, managing to suggest even more that he had not merely learned the song, but that he meant it. Eilish knew how sorry this man was going to be and how sorry she would be when the song had ended, when the last chorus had to be sung and the singer would have to bow to the crowd and go back to his place and give way to another singer, as Eilish too went back and sat in her chair. As the night wore on, some of the men fell asleep or had to be helped to the toilet. The two Miss Murphys made pots of tea and there was Christmas cake. Once the singing ended, some of the men found their coats and came to thank Father Flood and the Miss Murphys and Eilish, wishing them a happy Christmas before setting out into the night. When most of the men had left and several who remained seemed to be very drunk, Father Flood told Eilish that she could go if she wanted, and he would ask the Miss Murphys to accompany her to Mrs. Keogh's house. Eilish said no, she was used to walking home alone, and it would in any case, she said, be a quiet night. She shook hands with the two Miss Murphys and with Father Flood and wished each of them a happy Christmas before she set out to walk through the dark, empty streets of Brooklyn. She would, she thought, go straight to her room and avoid the kitchen. She wanted to lie on her bed and go over everything that had happened before falling asleep.
Well, from a novelist with a poet's ear for language, we now move on to a poet with a novelist's interest in the way real people inhabit the real world, the world of cities and suburbs, streets, hospitals, factories, family, neighbors, dogs, politics, all the bric-a-brac of a vividly observed present and a movingly recollected past. Philip Schultz is, as you've just heard, the founder and director of the Writers Studio, as I'm sure you all know. He's written several books of poetry, including Like Wings, nominated for the National Book Award, Deep Within the Ravine, which was the Lamont Poetry Selection of the Academy of American Poetry, and most recently, the book whose title broke the only serious F-word taboo in our culture, Failure, which very fittingly won the Pulitzer Prize in poetry. His new and selected poems, titled The God of Loneliness, is published this month by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it is an amazing distillation of a body of work that was already among the most powerful of any poet writing today. Failure in Phil Schultz's work refers most specifically to his father's epic struggles as a businessman in the Jewish immigrant community of Cuba Place in Rochester. But in a wider sense, it stands for all the grit and grime and drabness of ordinary life that has to be negotiated before any transcendence worth having can be claimed. Saul Bellow said famously that death is the dark backing that a mirror needs if we are to see anything. And I think failure has a similar function in these extraordinary poems. It is the backdrop that enables us to see and feel their real subject, which is nothing less than the strange, complicated, often overwhelming joy of being alive. Please welcome Philip Schultz.
Thank you, James. You know, I remember trying out titles for the book Failure, and I thought that Failure should be the title, and I asked a number of friends, and they each and every one said it's a dreadful title. You'll just be giving your critics ammunition, and you'll know the first, you know, it'll be the first line of your obituary, the author of, and until I asked James, and he just roared with laughter, I remember it, and he said, you have to call it that, it's the great American taboo, and so I thank you. And I also want to say that a year ago, almost to the day, I went to a literary conference festival in Galway, Ireland, and that's where I met Colm. And I was on the plane reading him. And I, you know, we were met by a cab driver to take us to the headquarters, the hotel. And it was just the two of us there. And I was reading his work. So it's an honor to be reading with you. I'd like to dedicate this reading to my dear friend and wonderful editor, Drenka Willen. I remember sitting in her living room, in your living room, and going over the poems. She helped me decide what I was going to include in the book by asking me to read the poems out loud. It was a wonderful, wonderful method. I suggest it for anyone. I'm going to read the poems chronologically from the earliest work on. The Artist and His Mother after Arshil Gorky. Such statuesque immobility. Here we have it, the world of form. Colors muted, a quality of masks with fine high brows. Light and its absence, alchemy. The hands are unfinished, but what could they hold? the transitory bliss of enduring wonder, mother, mother and son. Here we have it, consanguinity, the darkness inside color, space. In the beginning, there was space. It held nothing. What could it hold? Time, the continuum, mother and son, form suspended in color, silence. Her apron, a cloud of stillness swallowing her whole. Her eyes, roots of a darker dimension. Absence, here we have it, the world of absence. Light holds them in place. The pulse of time is felt under the flesh of color. Continuum, you feel such immensity, the anger of form, the woman locked in the mother, the man in the son in the mother. Their hands do not touch. What could they touch? Here we have it, the world of gift, the gift too terrible to return. But how could it be returned? In the beginning, there was anger, mother and son, the islands of time, the passion to continue, such statuesque immobility. The hands cannot be finished. Gorky never finished the painting. He actually did two magnificent versions of it, and there's always an endless controversy which version is better than the other. Like wings. Last night I dreamed I was the first man to love a woman and woke shaking and went outside to watch the faded rag of the sky burn into dawn. I am tired of the river before feeling the joy we must carve from shadow, tired of my road thick tongue. I cannot hand you my breath or wrap the horizon round your wrists and be forgiven. I cannot rub the dry wood of my ribs to fire and sleep. The edge of sleep is in sleep. I go room to room, tying my feelings into knots. The space we filled now fills me. The light and dark won't mix. I cannot leave myself like a house frozen in the background. I am this body and the weather all year round. I think of the light that opened over you our first morning, how the glass in my lungs turned to sound, and I saw you, woman and child, and couldn't breathe for love. Fear is the edge that is the risk that is loving. It stinks of blood, draws sharks. The night you waltzed naked round our bed, myself holding the chair I'd painted blue again, the cats flowing in the wings of your good yellow hair. There is much men don't know about women, how your hands work the air to water, the sea to life, why the salt at the tips of your breasts glows and tastes of mollusk. There are hours when the future gives up all hope and stops in the middle of busy streets and doesn't care. But think of the distance we have come, the hands which have wound us. There will be others. I have read of ancient people who held razors to their doctor's throat as he operated, as if love could have such balance, like wings. One night, I followed your tracks through deep snow and stood in an old schoolhouse watching the new sun come red and shimmer over the opening fields, the world white and flat, and a light I had known all my life burned in my head like a fist of rags. How I couldn't remember what we feared we had taken or left, my arms open to your shape. How I couldn't lift out of my body, my mouth frozen round the sound of your name. Balance. Some of these poems I haven't read for 20 years, at least. 8 years gone, and the welfare building is a parking ramp. The attendant can't recall where it went. Uptown somewhere, he thinks. But 10,000 people filled those halls, and only the ocean is a carpet big enough to sweep so many under. I was a clerk who read Chekhov and knew the fate of clerks. I learned to sway down halls like a dancer and never stopped to listen. Mornings I filed dental reports and wore earplugs against the crying for crutches, steel hands, and mattresses fitted to broken backs. A Mrs. Montvale perched on my desk and swore she'd kill herself if her new dentures didn't arrive by Thanksgiving. A fatalist with rotting gums, she feared dying toothless at a feast. Near closing time, the ghost lined up around the block, still waiting. In Central Index, I watched 100 Ferris wheels flip rainbow cards, sorting the dead from the quickly dying, and filed the electric buzz of computers into a symphony so grand it washed the curdled voices from my head. I'm glad the building's gone. Despair can't be tolerated in such numbers, and Gray's anatomy doesn't explain how the human body breaks 100 ways each day and still finds balance. Lord of mercy, the dead still need bus fare and salvation. Fifth Avenue in early spring. We are admiring Bergdorf's summer fashions, myself and this young couple who coo and flutter like cockatoos rife with seasonal pleasure. The girl dreams aloud about moonlit beaches while the boy, who obviously adores her, smiles as if to share the elegance of her long black hair, which lifts like mist curling off the nearby East River. Yes, she is lovely, balanced on her toes like a dancer, and I doubt if she is even thinking about returning to South Bend or Poughkeepsie, now that we have all survived another winter in this city, where one earns his papers slowly, and even the satisfactions can be disturbing. But this is a night when everyone is wistful, here on a street unlike any other, where even those of us who are no longer particularly innocent are suddenly happy to bear witness. This is like almost like rifling through a history book of your life. It's, you know, in putting this together, it was really difficult to relate to the man who was featured in many of these poems. I wasn't sure I'd want to be caught next to him on a long bus ride. All those bad love affairs, all those, I mean, they made decent poems, but still it must have been painful. Flying Dogs. In early spring, color pokes its chilly nose through the earth and reminiscing about past hibernation, with ocean winds inflating the sky one billowing cloud at a time, and trees shed metaphysical shadows that drift lazily along the river known for its sexual boasting, while brownstones rub against tediments like cats unfurling in windows. But it's the dogs who are flying. Gus, our smooth fox terrier, rises on white and brown spotted wings, while Benya, our black lab mix, loop-de-loops on powerful hawk wings, both gliding over rooftops, scaring up flocks of pigeons as neighbors climb onto fire escapes to watch them nosedive and whirl high over Charles Street. Dylan, the cross-eyed Dalmatian, is up there with Betsy, the Saluki, and Ruggles, the Chow Chow, who smells like Quasimodo. Is double-dipping Maddie, the ball-brained Irish setter, who'd go to Mars to fetch. And there's Hector, the submissive whippet, and his girlfriend, Tulip, the pertinacious Pekingese, whooping it up with Sir Quinton, the operatic golden, who's howling something Verdi over Sheridan Square. Yes, it's spectacular. Giant schnauzers somersaulting, Newfoundlands and Portuguese water dogs bounding over Great Pyrenees who can boogie-woogie with the best. Bearded colleagues, benighted Dobermans, and happy-go-lucky Akitas, forlorn bull mastiffs, beset Rhodesians, bandy malamutes, and feral hounds flying around water towers high over celebratory bridges stretching from one surprising moment to another in this city where I lived deep in winter long before I met you or imagined a smile so beguiling, light would thaw and the horizon vibrate like a violin string. On first hearing of your conception, this is for Eli. There's embarrassment. Premature, no doubt, my heading north through the kitchen to the dining room, which is south, but also west, depending on whether one is going forward to the future or backwards toward the middle of what used to be my life in the shadows of the living room, which is now a place you will pass through on your way to grander things. Indeed, one must ponder the importance of this autumn light, which seems more robust in each window. Yes, I am walking in circles while your mother reads about the drama of evolution, which took its time building toward its denouement from amoeba to somersaulting the hectic surf of our most epic journey. Weigh each drip of gravity, lift the tiny idea of your arms, defy the odds, evolve. Which he did indeed. These are from a long sequence of poems. A few. Grandma peeps from behind her shades at everyone peeping at her. The Italians are having people over in broad daylight, while the Slovaks are grilling goats alive. This means a 10-year stink. And the Ukrainians are mingling on their porches, plotting our downfall. Keep out of my yard, she cries in her sleep. Everyone sneaks around, has a hiding place. Uncle's police radio calls all cars to a virgin abducted on Main Street, while mother binges on Elman Joys and father sleepwalks through the wilderness of the living room, Odysseus disguised as a Zionist or a pickled beet. With my hands in my pockets and my pockets in my pants, watch the little girlies do the hoochie-coochie dance he sings every morning. Nights I sneak into the toilet where Uncle jumps out of the tub yelling, boo. I hide behind my eyes where even I can't find me. Everyone dickers with God. Everyone gets something. Grandma gets one dead husband who does nothing but read Torah and complain. The kitchen ceiling where all her curses live rent-free, a lifetime of oy vey's. Uncle gets his wieners, 8 varieties of sauerkraut, 5 newspapers spread over the kitchen table like a vast strategy. The Paramount screen where he pulls curtains shut on Marlena D., who shaves her legs 4 times a day. Father gets free room and board, a coal burner to intimidate all the blame. Mother gets the lower left half of the icebox where she hides bacon, popsicles, all her glee. I get the best hiding places, Uncle's girly books, the stained glass attic window where the wind sings of inner and outer things. As Martin Buber said, what are they but things? Oh, secrecy without a secret, oh, accumulation of information. I get faith and intuition in 5,763 years of longing and despair, a passion for hearsay, boogieing, and epistemology. It wasn't easy making these selections, and making a selection for a reading where you're just picking one or two from a book is really scaling things down. This is the last one from that book. All real living is meeting. Martin Buber said. True beings are lived in the present. The life of objects is in the past. It was Mr. Schwartzman's ambition to live in Buber's mind like a grand hotel high in the Swiss Alps, not exactly heaven or God, but far enough away from where we live our real lives. And from Failure of the Garden, in memory of Joel Dean, our dear neighbors. Years before I moved next door, Joel gave Jack gardening books, and Jack made a garden out of his passion for geometry and chance. He raked, clawed, and watered each peculiar vision until the daylilies were good company and the azaleas were immaculate and dignified. I used to stand on my side of the red cedars, listening to Jack's endless scraping, envying his devotion. I was alone then, but understood love was a gift, a vast, unbroken conversation. Yesterday, Jack scraped all morning on his hands and knees, weeding, plucking musical vines. Ask, and he'll say their 46 years was a garden of exquisite design. It's best to remember the peonies, the quaint delirium of lilacs, and Joel at the back door enjoying the reunion of cardinals, robins, and pesky blue jays, speaking the language of color and delight, the language of chance and endless change. Failure. To pay for my father's funeral, I borrowed money from people he already owed money to. One called him a nobody. No, I said, he was a failure. You can't remember a nobody's name. That's why they're called nobodies. Failures are unforgettable. The rabbi who read a stock eulogy about a man who didn't belong to or believe in anything was both a failure and a nobody. He failed to imagine the son and wife of the dead man being shamed by each word, to understand that not believing in or belonging to anything demanded a kind of faith and buoyancy. An uncle counting on his fingers my father's business failures, a parking lot that raised geese, a motel that raffled honeymoons, a bowling alley with roving mariachis, failed to love and honor his brother, who showed him how to whistle under covers, steal apples with his right or left hand. Indeed, my father was comical. His watches pinched. He tripped on his pant cuffs and snored loudly in movies where his weariness overcame him finally. He didn't believe in savings, insurance, newspapers, vegetables, good or evil, human frailty, history, or God. Our family avoided us, fearing boils. I left town, but failed to get away. These are some new poems, and I'm going to end a few new poems, and I'm going to end with a brand new poem. Things I have to do today. Check why my car engine's light keeps blinking. Shift two tutorials so I can attend Eli's play tomorrow. Make sure Prometheus Bound is by Aeschylus so I won't confirm his growing suspicion of my ignorance. Call Santos to patch and paint the upstairs ceiling leak. Get Monica to pick paint color before he gets too busy. Congratulate Joel and Odette on publishing their first stories. Adjust the basketball hoop before the boys grow any taller. Finish reading the Norwegian novel about a man living alone in the woods with his dog, even though the voice is so at peace with the trees and river and lights, it frightens me. Replace the outside lights so raccoons don't get into our garbage. Clip Penelope's nails and find a way to help my students be less afraid of what in them is most vulnerable, powerful, and unwilling to settle. Find the courage to begin the poem about a man at his window trying to imagine a place where the fragile chemistry of his happiness can survive is envy, ignorance, and guilt. Where the poor aren't tricked into believing poverty is a weakness and shame an inheritance. Where great wealth isn't made at the expense of the weak, the naive, and the frightened. Where his sons won't inherit his anguish and ignominy. Where his love for others is greater than his pity for himself. Where truth isn't despised by the bitter, the angry, and greedy. Where everything he loves isn't lost forever. Where the fire can survive even the anger of the gods unbound. Bleecker Street. It's a lovely June afternoon, and I'm heading up Bleecker Street for a hazelnut espresso latte, the kind made out of real hazelnuts, not syrup, hoping it will empty me of all my bickering ideas about love and fate and immortality so I can hear the fertile songs of spring. Miguel de Unamuno, whose name is impossible to say without smiling, believed self-love widens into love of all that lives. Thank God for Unamuno, for hazelnut lattes. But the infinite archaeology of my stupidity prefers the charms of self-pity to the equilibrium of self-love. Perhaps these three Chinese girls giggling into cell phones, lavishly spending each moment of their youth, truly believe the mountain of self has no top, and each breath is a reckoning with fate. Perhaps these shiny boutiques, each so resolute, so eager to please, are weary of decorating the illusions of another century, prefer the runaway slaves they hid in their root cellars, their dreams of slaughter and deliverance. Perhaps this beautiful blonde woman screeching to a stop in a lilac Mercedes, pursued by wailing police cars, finally understands that it is not only for the soul, but for the mind that happiness is a necessity. Is the rich bimbo stoned or just stupid? An old man radiant with rage screams. Perhaps everyone secretly admires something momentous about himself, something with the mass and inner life of a cathedral, in the tradition of the Spanish saints and mystics who cherish the bliss of infinite sacrifice. Perhaps the street remembers the loneliness of war widows, the roll call of absent names, its first kisses on the corner of West 10th Street, the swooning confetti heat of victory, the scalding springs of defeat. Indeed, the street is a wave of advocacy and streaming window peonies and tulips, a fierce glimpse of history, an echoing of nightly gunshots, a flag of black pigeons flowing east toward the end of a continent, a hunger for immortality, a tiny brusque city, a bickering idea, a useless boutique, a fertile song widening into a love for all that lives. The big sleep, it's a quote from Pascal. The only thing which consoles us for our miseries is diversion, and yet this is the greatest of our miseries. On Turner Classic Movies, Philip Marlowe is grimacing at the slinky beauty of the woman who will become the wife of the actor playing him. The man playing me, up at 3 this morning, worrying about the cost of private school, health insurance, and the slow grinding away of his savings, is wearing bleaching molds because a stain chart listed his smile as second to worst. On CNN, quaint dioramas of Baghdad, the Sudan, and Gaza depict recent forms of human misery. Is there a chart that measures our ignorance and vanity? On PBS, philosophers are debating what Nietzsche meant by our desire to create beyond ourselves the purest will. The sexual fire in the amber eyes of the woman Lauren Bacall is playing, perhaps. On the Western Channel, the whiteness of Joel McRae's teeth has survived dust storms, chewing tobacco, and his character's nostalgia for the brutality of his tiny moment. Some believe we've consumed our originality, that our diorama will depict nothing. On the Disney Channel, all 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence are shouting about the indignity of domination for everyone except perhaps those tending their fields and children. Did the man playing Nietzsche grow weary of trying to grow happiness out of pure will? Hat over heart, the man playing my father stood perpendicular to his exhausted, uneducated immigrant shadow, weeping to our national anthem. A man stood for something, he said. Did the actor playing Marlowe understand that Marlowe stood for nothing? On the History Channel, men and beasts are being slaughtered by machetes, explosions, and hangings, their swollen, mystified bodies falling into ravines, dropping to their knees, screaming for their mothers and God to save them. It's 3 a.m, and everywhere around me, the silence stands for nothing, and even the God playing God wants to sleep. A new poem. At the Manhattan Social Security Office. And it's a quote from Miguel de Unamuno. See, I'm smiling. The mind seeks what is dead, for what is living escapes it. I'm practicing the stoic art of insouciance, not because I prefer not thinking about what signing up for Medicare means or why so many who came after me are being called first, but because downstairs my soul was examined for signs of violence and duplicity. Its fatigue and ambivalence were invisible, apparently. In the next row, a man is telling a girl bobbing to an iPhone to sit still before the guard returns. When I was her age, signing up meant going to Vietnam, which meant practicing the Zen art of vanishing. At the windows, a blind man is asking why he didn't receive his disability payments in prison. He needs his sustenance. Behind me, another man is asking to see my paper. He's looking for work, he says. Happy to be free of Afghanistan, what can be done, I hand him my New York Review of Books. Bismarck said, explaining was a weakness. As her father explains the necessity of securing her future, the girl squirms. She fears only boredom. I feared everything. In 5 months, my father would die, and mother and I would live on the $200 a month his Social Security paid. At the windows, the blind man is practicing the existential art of groveling, exposing the stitches on his scalp to a clerk who's practicing the cynical art of indifference. The girl's soul, hovering near the ceiling, is enjoying its moment of radiance. My soul, fretfully pacing the water cooler, is practicing the fatalistic art of understanding that nothing can be done about Afghanistan, that in order to influence the future, we must kill it. Thank you.